through, clearing quite quickly but lingering across Shetland. Temperatures around 6 to 5 degrees. For Northern Ireland, we clear the rain quite quickly, but after morning sunshine, showers turn wintry, tending to snow over lower levels through the afternoon, and temperatures of around 4 degrees. More stormy weather to come on Wednesday, Carolyn.
Oh well, you did promise us it wasn't such good news. Thank you, Matt. And now we begin a new book of the week here on Radio 4. Our fascination for all things Scandinavian shows no sign of abating. And in The Almost Nearly Perfect People, The Truth About the Nordic Miracle, the journalist and self-confessed misanthrope Michael Booth embarks on a revealing and often humorous journey through all five of the Nordic countries to discover the secrets of their success. His personal, sometimes irreverent, quest begins in his adopted homeland of Denmark, where he has lived with his Danish wife and children for the past 10 years. The reader is Gunnar Kothery.
Early one dark April morning a few years ago, I was sitting in my living room in central Copenhagen, wrapped in a blanket and yearning for spring, when I opened that day's newspaper to discover that Denmark was the happiest place in the world. The happiest? This dark, wet, dull, flat little country that I now called home, with its handful of stoic, sensible people and the highest taxes in the world? Britain was 41st on the list. A man at a university had said it, so it must be true. In 2012, the United Nations' first ever World Happiness Report appeared, and Denmark was once again judged the happiest country in the world, with Finland second, Norway third, and Sweden seventh. The message was as clear as a glass of ice-cold schnapps. Yet for many of us, Scandinavia is terra incognita. We learn more from our school teachers, televisions and newspapers about the lives of remote Amazonian tribes than we do about actual Scandinavians and how they actually live. It was time to dig a little deeper into the Nordic miracle. Was there a Scandinavian template for a better way of living? Were there elements of Nordic exceptionalism that were transferable? Or was it a quirk of history and geography? And if people outside of Scandinavia really knew what it was like to actually live in this part of the world, would they still envy the Danes and their brethren quite so much? So I decided to go on a journey to try to fill in some of the gaps in my Nordic experience. And where better to start than at a party? Midsummer's Eve is one of the highlights of the Scandinavian calendar. Pagan in origin, but hijacked by the church and renamed in honour of Sankt Hans, St. John. In Sweden, they will be dancing around maypoles garlanded with flowers. In Finland and in Norway, they will have gathered around bonfires. Here in Denmark, in the garden of my friend's summer house north of Copenhagen, the beer and cocktails are flowing. At 10 o'clock, we gather around a fire to sing Vi elsker vårt land, we love our country. An effigy of a witch, assembled from old gardening clothes and a broomstick, is burned, sending her, my friend's 8-year-old daughter informs me, off to the Harz Mountains in Germany. The Danes are masters of revels such as these. They take their partying very seriously, are enthusiastic boozers, committed communal singers, and highly sociable when among friends. Most of the people assembled here will have left work early. The Danes have a refreshingly laid-back approach to their work-life balance, working almost half the number of hours per week they did a century ago, and significantly fewer than the rest of Europe. In practice, this means that most people knock off at around 4 or 5 in the afternoon. Annual leave is often as much as 6 weeks, and during July, the entire country shuts down as the Danes migrate en masse, like mild-mannered wildebeest, to their summer houses. More than 20% of the working population do no work, and are supported by generous unemployment benefits of up to 90% of previous wages for up to 2 years. Until recent reforms, it was 11 years. Once upon a time, the Danes ruled all of Scandinavia. They like their fairy tales, the Danes, but this one is true. The Kalmar Union of 1397 was a historic high point, with Queen Margaret I ruling a loosely unified Norway, Sweden and Denmark. The union held for over a century, until in 1520, the then Danish king Christian II rashly beheaded around 80 Swedish nobles in the so-called Stockholm bloodbath, something of a diplomatic faux pas. There followed centuries of territorial loss and defeat, first Sweden, then Norway, then Schleswig and Holstein, even Iceland, severed by that most unlikely of liberators, Adolf Hitler, when his army invaded Denmark in April 1940 and inadvertently relieved Iceland of its Danish head of state. Yet in a roundabout way, Denmark's losses were her making. Their greatly reduced circumstances bound the Danes together more tightly as a tribe than any of the other Nordic countries. No longer a great European power, Denmark withdrew, mustered what few resources remained within its much reduced boundaries, and began a process of what you could call positive parochialization. The Danes adopted a glass-half-full outlook, an urge towards insularity and national romanticism that is epitomized by a saying that every Dane knows by heart to this day. Hval udad tebes skal indar vindes. What was lost without will be found within. The Danes' recalibrated sense of identity and national pride has created a curious duality, best described as a kind of humble pride, though many often mistake it for smugness. Let me explain. Assuming that you know nothing about their country, within the first 5 minutes or so of meeting a Dane, they will usually say something along the lines of, "This is just a little land. We're only a little over 5 million people. We're pretty much all the same." They will probably add that they have no mountains or waterfalls, and that you can cross their country by car in 4 hours. But after a while, it can take anything from 5 minutes to a year, you will begin to detect the steely pride beneath the awe-shuck surface humility. That's when they might casually mention their world-leading wind turbine industry, the absence of poverty, their free education and health systems, and generous benefits. They will tell you how they are the most trustworthy and equal people in the world, how they have the best restaurant in the world, they are the world's leading pork butchers, slaughtering 28 million pigs a year, and yes, the Vikings will probably crop up as well. If you wanted to sum up Denmark in a single statistic, one peremptory and reductive yet insightful factoid, it has to be its tax rate. The Danes have the highest tax rates in the world, both direct and indirect. Income tax ranges from a base rate of 42%, in the UK it is 20%, up to the top level of 56%. On top of that is a church tax of a little over 1%. If you own your home, you can probably wave goodbye to around 5% of what's left to property taxes. If you use electricity, the government adds 76.5% to the bill. VAT is 25% and levied on everything you buy, including food and children's books. In the end, the total direct and indirect burden on the Danish taxpayer ranges from 58 to 72%. Put another way, in Denmark, even if you work in the private sector, you work for the state up until at least Thursday morning. And in case you're wondering, Danish wages are not correspondingly excessive. Only consider this. Over half of the Danish adult population, as much as two-thirds according to some estimates, either works in the public sector or is financially supported by it in the form of benefit payments. And the Danes have other dirty little financial secrets. They are highly enthusiastic shoppers on the black market, and they have gargantuan, world-leading private debt levels. Today, Danish households have the highest ratio of debt-to-income of any country in the Western world. The Danes owe, on average, 310% of their annual income. Two prime drivers of Danish conformism are Hygge and Fólkali. They are tricky to translate. The former is a deceptively relaxed and informal, uniquely Danish form of cosiness or conviviality, which is actually highly codified, with strict social rituals that exercise a relentless pressure to conform. The latter is a kind of broad-based cultural populism that pervades a good deal of Danish mainstream culture, and in a kind of reverse Midas effect, turns everything it touches to rubbish. Let us start with Hygge. You can often substitute the word cosy for Hygge. Didn't we have a hyggelig time at the pub quiz yesterday? Aren't those candles hyggelig? And so on. But Hygge also requires a quality of participation. It is decidedly uhugely for one person to hog the limelight, and a range of social skills, including teasing, quick repartee, the telling of stories and jokes, and the ability to be an enthusiastic audience as well as a performer. But over the years, I have come to detest Hygge. Its relentless drive towards middle ground consensus, its need to keep things light and breezy, the whole comfortable smugness of it all. Hygge is a highly effective way to skirt controversial topics or sweep unhappy memories under the carpet. OK, all right, so we had Norway and Schleswig-Holstein and lost it all, but do we really need to talk about it? How about another bottle of Amarone? Auntie Inge, a song. As for Fólkali, I have an even less ambiguous relationship to that. I loathe its whole Dixieland jazz-in-a-beer-garden forced bonhomie. Fólkali pervades a great deal of Danish popular culture and life. One must remain vigilant at all times if one is to have any hope of avoiding it. I failed to do this when I agreed to attend a residential choir week in Jutland. This was the single most intense period of exposure to Fólkali I have ever experienced, involving 6 days singing popular hits of the 70s and 80s, together with 400 retired public sector workers. By midway through the second day, I was experiencing a profound identity crisis. By the third day, I was making plans to leave Denmark forever. But by the fourth day, I had become strangely becalmed by the easy listening arrangements and collectivist atmosphere. In the evenings, after rehearsing all day, we would reassemble in the wake of a meal to sing Danish folk songs and hymns. Many of them had been written by Benny Andersen, the great Danish folk poet, now 83. Andersen even turned up in person for an evening in his honour, during which we sang his wry, bittersweet songs about Denmark. This little neurotic land of smiling, crazy people is one of his best-known lines. I feel a bit of a heel being critical about the kind, good-natured, gentle folk who attended the choir week. In truth, a more contented, kind, honest, community-minded group of people you could never hope to meet. The problem was that for a cynical misanthrope such as myself, prolonged exposure to Fólkali undoes me, smothers me, suffocates me. It's because I am bad. I had a standard question that I asked most of my interviewees. What are your fears for the future of Denmark? One word cropped up more than any other in their responses. Complacency. Many of my interviewees were worried that the Danes had had it too good for too long, that they were now content to sit back in their Arne Jacobsen swan armchairs and watch the spinning plates wobble and fall. But when asked whether they could think of a better country to live in, the answer was invariably a thoughtful silence. It was true when the wind is howling and the tax man is knocking, they might sometimes hanker for Tuscany or Provence. But in the ultimate analysis, none could name a better place to live than Denmark.
Gunnar Kothery was reading The Almost Nearly Perfect People, The Truth About the Nordic Miracle by Michael Booth. The book was abridged by Richard Hamilton and produced by Gemma Jenkins. Tomorrow at the same time, Michael's personal odyssey through Scandinavia continues. He discovers the Viking spirit is alive and well when he arrives in Iceland shortly after the 2008 financial crash.